We're getting there.
Let's go ahead and begin. Good morning, everyone. This is a title. Or this isn't a title setting board. I'm forgetting what today's meeting is. This is a rulemaking hearing concerning proposed rules for the Secretary of State's election rules. The date is November 30th, 2007. The time is 9:04 a.m. For the record, we're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm conducting the hearing on behalf of Secretary of State Mike Kaufman. Other introductions I'd like to make here at the table. To my immediate left is Andrea Geiger, who is a legal specialist with the Elections Division of the Secretary of State's office. To my immediate right is Wayne Munster, Deputy Director of the Elections Division of the Secretary of State's office. And then to my far right, Melody Murbaba is an Assistant Attorney General who represents the Secretary of State. Again, the purpose of the hearing is to receive comments from the public on the proposed amendments to the election rules. As stated in the notice of rulemaking that was published in the Colorado Register on November 10th, 2007, there are various amendments to the rules that arise from questions that the Elections Division has received, as well as legislation adopted in the 2007 session of the General Assembly that that requires new or amended rules. I'd like to take a few minutes to go through, just summarize some of the rule changes for the sake of explaining what some of the changes are about, and provide a little bit of information for the record about some of the proposed rule changes. I do want to note that there are sign-up sheets on the table by the back door, so anybody who wishes to testify on the rules, we would like for you to sign up on the sign-up sheets. So let me kind of just go through some of the rules. There is a couple of rules that deal with the vote. Initially, I'll sort of do this in order. Rule 2.6.3 clarifies that when an applicant for voter registration provides a Social Security number or a portion of the Social Security number, but does not indicate on the application form that he or she does not have a driver's license or identification card number, that the person shall not be registered. And there is a requirement under both state and federal law that if someone does have a driver's license number or state identification card, they're required to provide that number. And that's the basis of that rule. The amendments to Rule 2.7.2 are intended to clarify what happens when an applicant for voter registration does not check the boxes on the voter registration form that deal with citizenship or age. And the rule says that as long as the applicant does sign the affirmation that the person is of lawful age and is a citizen, then that person can be registered even if they didn't check those boxes. There are technical corrections and clarifications to various rules, 5.4.1, 38.7, 38.9, 44.4.5, and probably some others that I'll mention. There is some amendments to Rule 5.4.5 and 5.4.6 that are intended to clarify the procedures that deal with water conservancy districts, and they're intended to clarify the procedures for petitions and for the calling of an election for water conservation or water conservancy districts. There's a proposed new Rule 7.6. That deals with the time that a voter may spend in the voting booth. And in the proposed rules, there's really three alternatives that are laid out. Senate Bill 83 from the previous session amended the election code, specifically 1-7-115, to require the Secretary of State to adopt rules on this subject. The statute, I think, for many years just simply provided that 10 minutes was the limit for a voter in the voting booth. And the legislature wrestled with that this past session and I think kind of punted to the rules. And so we're trying to figure out what is workable. You know, one of the alternatives, I think, bases it on the part of the difficulty is that the length of the ballot varies a lot from election to election. And so two of the proposals are designed to provide a flexible standard based on either the length of the ballot or how long it takes to read it. And I think the third proposal simply changes the 10-minute limit to 20 minutes. But all of the proposals, as I recall, make exceptions for persons with disabilities that need additional time. There is a proposed amendment to Rule 12.1.1.1 to require the county clerk and recorder to notify voters that additional postage may be required to return a voted mail or mail-in ballot. And part of the issue there, I think, for us is, and this is something that came up in some jurisdictions this past election, and an issue for us is, does there need to be any rule about this at all, or if there does, should it be a stronger rule? I think some people felt that clerks should tell voters exactly how much postage is required. In reality, I think that there's some administrative difficulties for clerks to do that. So the middle ground of the proposed rule, I think, is simply to require that voters be advised that there may be additional postage required. There is a proposed amendment to Rule 26.1.5 that deals with provisional ballots, and it simply clarifies that for purposes of provisional ballots, the term statewide offices includes a justice of the Supreme Court or a judge of the Court of Appeals. There's a new rule, proposed rule 26.1.6, that deals with the system that electors can access free of charge to determine if their provisional ballot was counted. And as I recall, this is a requirement from HAVA. The proposed rule would require that system be available for at least 30 days after the election. And the rule is also intended to clarify that the telephone number is not, that the having simply a toll-free number is not necessarily sufficient. A local number is not necessarily sufficient, as I recall. Let's see, new rules 37.3.3 and 37.3.4 address questions that have come up recently from some of the clerk and recorders about a section of the law that deals with voting system standards. And specifically, there is a concern that one reading of the statutes is that once the 2005 voluntary voting system guidelines take effect in Colorado on December 13th of this year, that clerks will no longer be able to purchase voting equipment unless it meets the 2005 standards. And there is no equipment yet that has been certified either federally or under the state process to the 2005 standards. And that reading then would prevent clerks from purchasing equipment on and after December 13th of this year. We have consulted with the AG's office. We think that's not a correct reading. And the rule is intended to reflect what we think a full reading of the applicable statutes allows, you know, what it would allow clerks to do. There are amendments to Rule 38 that are intended to meet the requirements under Senate Bill 83 that the Secretary of State establish requirements for equipment used at vote centers. And these amendments would clarify minimum contingency and security procedures for vote centers, minimum standards for data encryption, minimum electronic poll book requirements, the minimum number of computers in a vote center, procedures for electronic poll book pre-election testing, and there's some other technical corrections. And I want to emphasize that these are proposed as the minimum standards. They don't prevent additional procedures or standards to be instituted at the county's discretion. And also, these rules 38.1.4 through 38.3.4 do not apply to printed or paper poll books because they're not connected to other computers. Those rules apply only to electronic poll books that are used for vote centers or for early voting. We had some written comments, I think, from some clerks about 38, the proposal on 38.1.4, and I think there was some confusion on our part from staff about what the comments were. So maybe if there's folks that are testifying specifically on 38.1.4, we might want to be sure we understand the written comments that we've received. There are amendments that deal with the Election Official Certification Advisory Board and the certification process. These amendments are intended to clarify just the procedures and the process, and those are amendments that are in Rule 40 or and 40.5 and 40.8 and so forth. There are amendments to Rule 43.8.7.1 to clarify the procedures for delivering and logging the receipt of election equipment prior to opening the polls. There is a proposed new Rule 44.5 to establish requirements and procedures for a voter registration drive to renew their registration with the Secretary of State. And there's also a new Rule 44.6 to create a process by which the Secretary of State can receive complaints, review the complaints, and investigate the complaints involving voter registration drives before the Secretary of State is authorized to impose a fine. And as I recall, this arises out of amendments in Senate Bill 83 of the past session. That's kind of an overview of some of the proposed changes. Again, it's a formal rulemaking hearing. Our purpose is to hear the comments and, you know, whether the rules are needed and whether they're accurate and or whether they could be improved. As I indicated earlier, we do have sign-up sheets on the table. Please do sign up if you would like to testify. If you represent a group, please identify the group that you represent. The hearing, by the way, is recorded as a formal rulemaking hearing, and it's also being broadcast on the internet. And I think that's the housekeeping procedures that I wanted to cover. And then I'd like to turn to the public testimony, and I'll just work off of the sign-up sheet. I'll start with the first person, Jack Arrowsmith. If you would like to, do you want to test? I see you didn't necessarily indicate whether or not you wanted to testify or not, so I could come back to you if you want.
That would be great.
Okay. Debbie Green, I don't know whether you want to testify or not.
I'll wait.
Okay. Larry Beer, I don't know. Okay. Okay. I'm looking for people who signed up but also indicated that would like to testify. Carrie Lackland? Yes. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing us to speak and
reference to these rules. My name is Kerry Lackland. I'm an attorney from Boulder, Colorado. I'm associated with Coloradans for Voting Integrity, which is a statewide election advocacy group to work for better elections in Colorado. We were intimately involved in the amendment and passage of Senate Bill 83 during the last legislative session. We appear today to comment on some of the rules that have been proposed as a result of that bill and also other rules. The first rule that I'd like to comment on is 2.7.1, and I believe that this rule should be changed to allow a voter to register provisionally and provide ID at a later time. And I realize that voter IDs are a big topic in Colorado and nationally, but if a voter is registering by mail, either by at the motor vehicle department or by a form that's mailed in, I would submit that the voter should be allowed to submit that form, provide an ID at a later time, and it shouldn't require that the voter provide the copy with the registration form itself. We'd also like to comment on 2.11. This relates to a voter having been reduced from a active voter to an inactive voter. Generally, we oppose the process in which voters are determined not to be active voters. It seems to us that once a voter goes through the process of registering to vote, providing appropriate IDs and information to the clerk of the county in which he resides, that merely not voting in an election should not punish him or punish that voter by being reduced from active to inactive. This becomes especially important now that there is discussion about mail ballot elections in Colorado. There is some talk in the legislature and from statements by Secretary Kaufman that if the electronic DRE machines are decertified, that there may be a movement afoot to move to all mail ballot elections, which we would oppose. Part of the reason we oppose that is because under these rules, if there is a mail ballot election, the only voters that get the mail ballot sent to them are active voters. And I think to require an inactive voter to submit a request in writing to activate his registration or to become an active voter is an undue burden. And I think the prior procedure where perhaps a telephone call to the clerk saying, I understand I'm an inactive voter, I haven't received a ballot, I want to become an active voter, a telephone call should be sufficient. And we should not be putting up hurdles to prevent voters from receiving mail ballots or from remaining as an active voter. We'd also like to comment on 7.6, which is the time to vote. Our concern is that that voters be allowed sufficient time in the voting booth, given their individual peculiarities of each voter, to cast a ballot. And I was hoping that Ken Brenner, who's here, will testify about the Broward County problem that he was involved in 2006. He was a county commissioner. He actually performed an experiment during the early voting process in Broward County to try to determine approximately how long it took voters to cast the complicated ballot in 2006. And as a result of his study, he determined that I believe it took voters approximately 10 minutes. He then made a calculation of what was going to happen on election day. And the fact that Route County is now on a watch list because they had four-hour waits at their voting centers and polls had to remain open into the late night hours of Election Day show that in that county there was insufficient machines to accommodate the turnout. We believe that the 20-minute rule is probably sufficient. We would ask that the Secretary of State amend that rule with an additional language saying that the Secretary of State, pursuant to investigation or experiments, or timed experiments during the early voting process, may determine that 20 minutes is not sufficient. I have no idea what the 2008 ballot is going to look like statewide, but I'm confident that it's going to be a high turnout election. There's going to be great interest both nationally, locally, in the races and the issues that are on this ballot. And I would submit that if during the early voting process, 2 weeks before the election, the Secretary of State determines that 20 minutes per voter on average is not sufficient, that the Secretary of State should be able to issue emergency rules prior to Election Day that allow clerks to expand that 20-minute period if necessary. We think that's a better rule. It's hard for us to imagine election judges dragging voters out of voting booths, but I think the purpose of this rule is to prevent somebody from kind of occupying voting booths, also to prevent other voters from voting. So I think that 20 minutes is an appropriate alternative there. We would ask that it be clear that the Secretary of State, pursuant to the emergency rule, could expand that if it became evident. We'd like to comment on 12.1.1.1. We believe that the counties should pay the postage on return mail ballot ballots. That could be done by some kind of franking stamp, which would then be billed by the U.S. Post Office to the county. I think this was a huge problem in many counties when ballots were not returned by the post office and were returned to the voter, which they received after Election Day because of insufficient postage. In Denver, the instructions on the outside of the return ballot misinformed the voter about what postage was necessary, and I think resulted in disenfranchisement of a great number of Denver voters during that 2004 and 2006 election. I don't think there's any reason why the state should not pay for the return of mail ballots. This is a type of poll tax on poor voters who have to pay to cast their vote, and I submit that it's unconstitutional and that the state should work out a system where there's a franking stamp on the return envelope that will pay whatever postage is required to return that ballot to the clerk for casting of that ballot in the election. As an alternative, we submit that the instruction should be on the outside of the return envelope and not on the secrecy sleeve, because the secrecy sleeve is inserted inside the return envelope. The voter seals that envelope and then takes it to the post office for mailing, and if the instructions are sealed inside the return envelope, the voter has no idea what postage is going to be required. So I submit that putting the instructions on the secrecy sleeve or the secrecy envelope is insufficient. It should be required to be on the outside of the return envelope in a prominent position on the face of the envelope so the voter is clear that if there is no franking rule, that there may be extra postage due. Although Rule 37.3.1 is not changed under these proposed rules, we again submit that the Secretary of State's office is ignoring ballot marking devices in its rules. And we raised this at the last hearing that we had here regarding the prior set of rules, and Mr. Hobbs informed us that the ballot marking devices were a statute under Senate Bill 83 and didn't necessarily need to be named. But I submit that as these rules mature and that they should accommodate all of the voting machines that are allowed in Colorado. Ballot marking devices now are clearly allowed. We are confident they're going to be certified by the Secretary of State's office in Colorado in December. Ballot marking devices are certified in 48 other states. They're in use in over 29 states, the majority of states, and that number is increasing as we speak. New York is about to adopt ballot marking devices as their HAVA-compliant voting machine, and other states are moving away from DRE machines to paper ballot and ballot marking device-based systems. So we would request that the Secretary of State's office amend the rules, and specifically 37.3.1, to specifically refer to ballot marking devices as a type of machine that can be used in Colorado. Our concern with the rest of Rule 37 was a concern that the purpose of this amendment to Rule 37 was to allow county clerks to buy machines this time on the eve of decertification or certification decision by the Secretary of State, machines that only meet 2002 voting system guidelines. I'm reassured by Mr. Hobbs' statements today that this is an accommodation to the clerks who are concerned about having sufficient machines that are certified under at least the 2002 rules for use in the 2008 election. We clearly don't want any rule to be interpreted in such a way, in combination with state statute, that would be a retreat from the progress that Colorado has made away from paperless DRE machines to a paper trail. We do not think that, as an organization, CFEI does not believe that paper trails are sufficient. We think Colorado should move towards a paper-based ballot where voters can actually see their vote on a piece of paper before it's deposited in a ballot box or a optical scanner. And but we would oppose any retreat from even the use of paper trail DRE machines. I think that concludes my comments on the proposed rules. Thank you for the opportunity to address you today.
Thank you, Mr. Lackland. Let me just see if I don't think I have any follow-up questions, but I just kind of want to make sure that if there's anybody else here that Ms. Marbaba.
Your reference to the ballot marking devices, do you have any specific ones in mind?
Well, I don't. I'm not here advocating for any particular machine. I think that there are ballot marking devices under development. AutoMark is marketed by ES&S and Diebold. I believe that ES&S submitted the AutoMark ballot marking device during the certification process in Colorado and actually demonstrated it at the public demonstration. So I think that's on the agenda for the Secretary of State to certify or not certify at this time.
Are you aware that the AutoMark, they withdrew their application?
No, I wasn't aware.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, there are other companies developing ballot marking devices, and I think that is the way American elections are going to evolve. And I think it's time for Colorado to certify a ballot marking device. I'm disappointed that ES&S withdrew the AutoMark. It may have been a result of the problems they're having in California about AutoMark, but I think we think it's a good machine. Allows a voter to cast a ballot that is a paper ballot that they can see. It allows a disabled voter to vote on the same type of ballot as every other voter, which I think eliminates the problem of second-class ballots for disabled voters.
Thank you.
And I know there's because I know there's questions about that. I do want to confirm that I think ES&S was the only vendor that had submitted
right.
a ballot marking device, and it was the AutoMark, and they did withdraw that part of their application a few weeks ago.
We're obviously disappointed in that, but we're sure that.
Thank you, Mr. Lackland. Ken Brenner.
Good morning. As Americans, probably one of our most valuable rights, if not our most valuable right, is that of responsibility, is to vote. And in 2006, in Rauch County and other places in the state, we saw that compromised. And I wanted to take the time to come down today and share with you a little bit about what our experience was and some suggestions that we've made.
And Mr. Brenner, if I might ask you then for the record, and I think I recall from what Mr. Lackland said, I think I know who you represent and so forth, but maybe just for the record, if you'd
take
that.
Thank you. Ken Brenner. I am a past city council member. I just retired. I was term limited. And I've been the Rauch County Democratic Party chair for the last 4 years. In 2006, we tried very hard to, and I want to preface all this by saying that I think our county clerk has worked very hard to provide fair elections. We're kind of moving into a new era of voting, and it's difficult to, I think, always anticipate all the challenges that we'll face. We went forward with voting centers for the first time and had what we thought was a pretty good system worked out. I don't think the logic and accuracy test was completed prior to early voting. That was an error that we will try to avoid in the future. And we did see some challenges there that were not corrected during that period of time, and that was reflected with some problems during the actual election. The voter turnout didn't really get heavy until the final day of early voting on a Friday, and that was the first day that we really got some accurate estimates of what kind of volume to expect and how long it would take and what was our capacity to be able to handle the number of voters. And I read those numbers in the paper and had a chance to talk with the clerk first thing on Monday morning. It was at that point I realized, we did some simple math, realized it was only going to be about 100 voters that could vote per machine, and that was without problems. And when I found out that we only had 35 machines, I mentioned to the clerk that that was only going to be about 3,500 people that could vote that day, and that I was anticipating a turnout of probably closer to 5,000. The response was, well, they'll just have to wait in line. And I tried to explain that waiting in line wouldn't help you vote because the capacity just physically wasn't there. I believe she checked with the Secretary of State's office, came back. We had the same discussion again. I think I was probably a little more emphatic about how there had to be a backup paper ballot available for people if the lines got long. I was given the same answer, is that we needed to anticipate people were having to wait, and they could have to vote if they waited. Well, Election Day was everything that I anticipated and worse. We did have poll watchers at every poll, so we had a chance to actually observe from 7 in the morning until the polls closed at 7, and people voted until 11 o'clock at night, what some of the problems were. We saw very hard, I think that they tried very hard to keep things moving. We didn't have the technical assistance. There was one representative for the HART machines in Northwest Colorado. So when the machine went down, we had several machines go down, they had to respond from Rangeley, which is a full 2-hour drive. We saw really a kind of a unique situation in that, I mean, very few people anymore will sit around for 2 hours to do anything. And we had an hour wait before 8 o'clock. We had over 2-hour waits before lunch, and by the end of the day, it was a full 4 hours that people were waiting. So they were bringing coolers with them. We had pizza parties. It was actually quite a social event for most people. But unfortunately, many people came and left. It would be very difficult to determine how many, because along with the ones that you physically count leaving, there are always those that are told don't even bother to go because of the lines. So that was the kind of the fallout. We took what we saw and sat down and wrote a report that had 18 different suggestions that we've turned in to you. And I want to thank the Secretary of State for his response to those, and actually he took the time to come up to Rauch County, meet with us, meet with the Republican Party as well, meet with the clerk, and talk about what happened and what we might want to do differently. And so, again, I want to thank you for that response. I'd like to use an analogy. I'm also an FIS technical delegate for alpine ski racing. I officiate at the highest level of international ski racing. And we would never consider having a ski race without three timing systems. We have a primary electric system. We have a secondary electronic system that's completely independent. And then we always have a manual system that backs up. We never miss a time. We always get the race right. These are scrutinized by an international committee each year. All the results from the races are reviewed. And this is to ensure that integrity and accuracy that's essential for the perpetuation of the sport. The other thing is that we would never time a race. And the timing, you know, when you go to a race, and I have the responsibility of checking to make sure all the entries are correct and that no one's in the race and that their point profile is accurate and updated and that the snow conditions are good and the course is set correctly and the safety is there. But the most important thing we do is time the race. No one would show up if we didn't do that. So it's much the corollary would be that we wouldn't have an election if we couldn't guarantee that everybody that wanted to got a chance to vote, that could legally vote, and that we could guarantee there was an accurate count of those elections. The timing systems that we use are homologated. That's what we call certification. And you would never homologate any equipment that hadn't been thoroughly tested for several years under race-like conditions. And that's how they are, and they're certified or homologated through an international committee. They're very carefully scrutinized. I do not, from what I have read in the paper, have confidence that that level of scrutiny is taking place yet with the certification process that we're going to use for the electronic voting machines. That's something that I think you're going to have to show to the public that you have that integrity, that you have that confidence, that we have a system that absolutely works. We can't put it in as our primary system of counting votes if we don't, if we can't assure everyone that that is the case, that it has that integrity. I wanted to mention that there has been talk about a mail, all-mail ballot, and I think that would really be a mistake. The mail ballot has some real problems with only using an active voter list when there's people, a lot of people, especially after the 2006 election, that did not vote because of the circumstances. They're also very likely going to end up in a garbage can in a post office, and how do we guard against, you know, that lack of integrity just isn't what we're trying to have. This should be the highest standard that we can possibly offer. Let me tell you a little bit about what the Rouse County Clerk's Office has done in response. In the 07 election, they mailed absentee ballot request form to every registered voter in the county. They also mailed instructions. These instructions included the three different systems of voting, whether you could request an absentee ballot and vote early that way for a whole month before the election. There were 2 weeks of early voting available. We actually printed the hours that were available. We had encouraged the clerk, and they responded by extending the hours so that they were now from 8:30 until 6. We also had voting available on Saturday from 8:30 until 4:30. When we got an absentee ballot form back, the clerk followed that up with a phone call. Obviously above and beyond the call of duty, but certainly someone that was dedicated to trying to make sure that we contacted everyone and gave them the opportunity to vote. I guess I would just close in saying that we have always counted in ski racing on having a backup system that was absolutely bulletproof. I can't tell you how important I think it is to make sure that every polling place in the state of Colorado has a paper ballot backup, so that if a line gets too long or if someone requests a paper ballot, they have that available to them. Thank you very much.
Mr. Brenner, could I ask one follow-up question,
yes,
if you don't mind? I just wanted to clarify a little bit about, you know, the idea of timing. We have the proposed rule with several options. And just by way of background, I think historically election officials have not timed voters at all, even though there was a 10-minute limit in the statutes. Mm-hmm. And especially with longer ballots, I think an awful lot of voters took 10 minutes or more. But you know, I think, as someone stated, I think one of the ideas here is that somebody might actually just attempt to permanently occupy the voting booth, for example. So, I mean, that's sort of where the I think the statute and the rule may be coming from. But I wanted to clarify kind of what your recommendation would be on that rule. I mean, we've got one option that says it would be 20 minutes, and a couple of other options that would sort of be kind of variable depending on the length of the ballot, perhaps. And I just didn't quite understand what perhaps you were suggesting.
And I'm not sure I was very clear. It's a balance between allowing people an adequate amount of time to review the ballot, and 06 is a good example of a long and fairly complex ballot, versus the chance that somebody is intentionally trying to tie up the polls by staying in a poll too long. I don't have a specific recommendation. I think that the ballots are going to require at least 10 minutes in the future. 20 minutes, I don't think you want to wait longer than that, because then you're actually getting into a situation where people are going to have you're going to have that chance of someone intentionally trying to tie up the polls. Another thing that the clerk did in Rock County was that they provided a sample ballot where you first entered the building, so that while you were waiting in line, you had a chance. We had people, even at the end, where we voted for 4 hours after they'd locked the doors, everybody had a pretty good idea what they were going to do. They had a fair amount of time to study the ballot and be ready. The only challenge that we had there was we did actually run out of those sample ballots. So that might be another emergency. And if you don't mind, I'd like to follow up with the homologation question or the certification question. You never, like in ski racing, you never really find out how well equipment works until you test it in a race condition. That's where things will goof up. You can easily bring a few athletes out and run through a course and time it and go, yep, everything's good to go, and then on race day find all kinds of catastrophic things. And it's really only over a period of time of testing the equipment year after year in race conditions that we actually find out if the equipment is reliable. And more equipment is found unreliable than reliable. And a great deal of care and expertise goes into constructing and certifying and maintaining that equipment. Each piece of equipment is certified each year and can be pulled off if there's any problems during the previous year. It's with that type of an ethic that I hope we approach the certification of this equipment. It's a daunting challenge you have there, and it's not easy to do a race condition election to really find out how good the equipment is, but that's the challenge that we have.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Jenny Flanagan. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Jenny Flanagan. I am the director of Colorado Common Cause. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on the proposed rules today. I think you just got the comments. Sorry, I wasn't able to provide them in advance. I'll just walk through my comments, and then obviously if you have any questions. The first rule we'd like to comment on is Rule 2.6.3. This is a dialogue that I certainly have with the Secretary of State, and as the legislature has addressed this issue of voter registration, we're concerned that this rule creates a problem for voters who are attempting to register but may not have their identification on them at the time that they fill out a registration form. This can be very problematic, as many people who don't drive but maybe, you know, walking down the street or participating in a voter registration drive may not have that identification number. A better practice, rather than not registering that voter or entering their information into our databases, would be to enter that information, provided that the form is complete as we would otherwise and as we had in the past, and then tag them or note on their record that they are ID deficient, and then provide them an opportunity to give that proper documentation at a later date up to or on election day. This will preserve their right to vote in the many circumstances rather than putting them in a pile or attempting. I know many of the clerks will attempt to contact those voters to give them that opportunity, but again, we think a better practice would be to enter them into the system, tag them as deficient for identification, and provide them an opportunity to remedy that problem. by having them in the database, it just affords them the likelihood that their vote will be counted on Election Day. We also oppose Rule 2.11, which would require an elector to give written notice to change their status from inactive to active. We agree that the inactive voter law in our state is problematic. It's having a large impact on tens of thousands of voters, certainly as was discussed during a mail election where they won't receive a mail ballot, or in other circumstances not receiving election mail. One of the arguments why it's not a problem, because to have this inactive law, was that it was so easy to reactivate your status that you could just call your county office and inform your election official that you wanted a ballot, and they could then put it in the mail for you. This eliminates that opportunity. The other potential problem with this, and I'm not sure what the secretary was thinking in this rule, is would this have an impact on an inactive voter that went to a polling place on Election Day and wanted to participate? Typically, an inactive voter could walk into the polling place and be reactivated right there. Would there be another form for an election judge to fill out and then submit to the county clerk? Would the polling place become an authorized agent of a county clerk? We're not sure how that would impact the polling place interaction of an inactive voter. This provision would create an administrative hurdle for the voter to go through, but also for the county clerks to have to go through more paperwork and more confusion in order to meet this need. And as with all voting policies, we should be encouraging people to participate and not creating more hurdles that make it more difficult. On Rule 7.6, of the three alternatives, we lean toward the third, giving 20 minutes. Mostly for the reason that the other two alternatives are very confusing and complicated from our perspective. We think this would create a different time scenario for every ballot style, potentially. The county clerks would be sort of, you know, forced to calculate every potential ballot style, come up with a number. I think this would add confusion both for our counties and for our voters. And having one standard seems the best option. On Rule 12.1.1.1, this is the rule requiring postage information for mail ballots. We appreciate the effort to give more information to voters. This is something we hear a lot of confusion about from voters on Election Day and during the periods of mail balloting, that they just don't know what the postage requirements are. So while it's good to at least let them know that they may need additional postage, and I understand there's a lot of complications when we're preparing for mail balloting, we think the best alternative is to provide the actual amount that a voter would be required to mail, or to inform voters that the counties will cover any deficient cost, which is the practice that currently goes on. I think that fear of the voter of thinking their ballot is going to be returned to them, not knowing what the outcome will be, is problematic. Voters should have confidence when they mail in a ballot that ballot will be processed and counted. We also agree with CFVI that the state should carry that cost. But we know our state has a lot of financial challenges. Our next comment is on Rule 37 regarding the voting system standards and guidelines, particularly Rule 37.3.4. And I apologize, I missed your description in the beginning, but I think I understand that the goal is to allow counties to purchase equipment that have already been certified, maybe in between the adoption of new rules and that sort of thing. I guess our concern with this rule is that it potentially opens the door beyond 2008, that gives sort of permission for our state to not consider future guidelines that have been outlined by our Election Assistance Commission. And we believe that our statutes make clear that Colorado is required to follow the rules promulgated by the Election Assistance Commission. So while there may be some circumstances where it's appropriate to use outdated certifications and technologies, for example, if a county is already using a system and maybe they need to replace equipment, or they have their population growth requires them to sort of fill in the machines that they already have, that may be a circumstance where it makes sense. But I don't think that we should set down a path where we ignore the changing technology and the needs that have been identified by these federal testing standards. I think a lot of time and energy goes into it, a lot of experts weigh in, and our technology is very much still developing to meet the needs of accessibility, to improve our security and auditability of these machines. With all of the chaos around electronic voting, I think we are wise to follow the guidance of what's happening on a federal level to make sure that our systems are of the highest standard. Our last comment is on the electronic poll book planning. And again, here, we supported this change in Senate Bill 83 to create greater guidance for counties. So the challenges that Rao County or other counties experienced with the new use of vote centers could be minimized, and we could really learn from some successful practices. Our concern with this rule is again balanced. We understand that counties are going to need to plan for the election well in advance of Election Day, so that a 90-day plan makes a lot of sense. Our concern is that if you limit, or if we only plan based on who is registered 90 days in advance of the election, we're forgetting the thousands of voters who are going to register in the week leading up to the deadline of voter registration. And again, we know many counties know that and anticipate in their election planning what the influx may be and what their projected turnout are. And that's a challenge. Certainly Denver has expressed challenges in election planning in that way, and I'm sure all the counties have challenges. We would just encourage the Secretary of State in the rules to acknowledge that challenge so that counties are not sort of restricted only to what's on the books, but what they might anticipate the turnout to be or increased registration numbers to be. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Faith Groth.
Good morning and thank you. Faith Groth, representing the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People. And I'm going to keep my comments pretty brief. And I'm going to, I would like to, at the end of my comments on the rules, just say a few things about the automark withdrawal. First of all, I want to say that I fully agree with everything that the Common Cause has said today. And just wanted to add a couple of comments. For proposed rule 2.6.3, I am a voter registration drive organizer, and I do know from our work in the past that many voters, even though we are the Legal Center and we are bound by confidentiality rules and we take the confidentiality requirements for voter registration drives very seriously, people have commented to me that they're reluctant to provide more than the last four digits of their Social Security number when registering to vote. And I do assure folks that we maintain these confidentially. We actually keep a copy of every voter registration drive application that we send in to the counties, but we also black out Social Security numbers, driver's license numbers, and state ID numbers. And we assure folks that, but people are still reluctant. The other issue that we find is that many voters with disabilities do not have driver's licenses and may have a state ID card, but they do not carry that around with them all the time. So they would not have that number available and oftentimes have not memorized that number. For 2.11, we fully agree with Common Cause, and we do have a concern that having to do this in writing would be very burdensome for many voters with disabilities, and particularly for elderly voters. Rule 7.6, we support Alternative 3. I think it's the most straightforward and simple rule. It does seem to be a reasonable amount of time in the voting booth for most elections, and I agree with Mr. Lackland that in a situation where the ballot would be extraordinarily long, then perhaps emergency rulemaking would be appropriate. Rule 7.6.2, We really like this rule. We think it's an excellent example of reasonable modification of policies and procedures that is required under the Americans with Disabilities Act. The concern that I have is that this to me appears to be a training issue for election judges. And I don't know if this needs to be addressed in the rules or in the training manual that your office puts out to the counties. I'm aware that at least in some counties they don't use that election judge training manual that you provide. They have their own. And I'm just concerned that judges will need to really understand that this is an accommodation, that this is a rule, that this is required by law. And then my question is, how do they know that this is a voter with a disability? If this is a voter who has, say, a learning disability or other type of cognitive disability, that's a hidden disability. So then does the voter have to disclose in advance that I have a disability and I'm going to need extra time in the voting booth? Or many voters won't know that until their 20 minutes are up. So I'm just a little bit concerned about how this would be implemented, but I'm very happy to see it in here. I just think that maybe it needs to be identified as a very specific training issue.
May I ask on that one, I mean, would you recommend that, I mean, as far as how that ought to be handled, is that judges should not inquire? I mean, if a voter simply says, I have a disability, would you recommend that voters that the judges not inquire about the nature of the disability or any proof of it or anything like that? I mean, what should we tell election judges?
And I think this is in the materials that I've provided to your office.
Okay.
Sort of best practices. I would be very unhappy if I heard of a judge asking a person what their disability was or to prove their disability. That's not
sure.
The rule of an election judge, and I don't think that's appropriate in this circumstance. So it would just be the person would have to, you know, to say, I have a disability,
that's
period.
Sufficient.
And that should be sufficient.
Thank you.
Can I follow up with that? So if a person with a disability doesn't just volunteer that information, are you suggesting that that's it?
I guess if the person, and this is why I'm talking, this is a training issue.
Right.
If a person's in the booth for more than 20 minutes, and actually I will share with you that when I first started doing this work, I worked as an election judge during the 2004 primary, and we did have one very elderly voter who was spending more than the 10 minutes. And so at that point, I just went and just from the other side of the curtain said, are you having any problems? And she said, no, I'm fine. Everything's fine. I just need more time. And that was, for me, I thought that was reasonable. I mean, she was clearly, she looked like she was maybe 90 or 100 years old. She was very elderly. So it seemed to me very reasonable that she would need more time.
But is it your recommendation that election judges should not at all inquire as to whether a person has a disability? You know, the simple yes or no question, not inquiring further as to what the disability is, but whether they have one prior to going into the voting booth.
Prior to going into the voting booth? Yes, I would say do not ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
The 20 minutes is up and the person's still in the voting booth, then I would say, you know, then it would be okay to say, is there a problem or an issue?
Okay.
And I would ask that of any voter, and then the voter can say, yes, because I have a disability, it's taking me more time.
Thank
you. Or if voters just says, I need more time, then maybe you would get a dialogue going.
Okay.
But to ask any voter before going in to vote if they have a disability makes me very uncomfortable. Very, very uncomfortable. Let's see. Proposed rule 12.1.1.1, fully agree with previous comments on this. I noted that of the amount of postage was crossed out. I'm wondering why that decision was made to cross that out. Most people are not going to know how much postage is needed. So I think it's really important that voters be informed how much postage is needed. And I fully agree with Jenny Flanagan that ideally the government should be paying the cost of postage.
You know, if I may, one elaboration on about that issue for us was there are a couple of different reasons that I've heard why it's hard for the clerks to know in advance what the amount is. And the main one is that the postage may depend on whether the voter has to include ID when they return the ballot. And so the weight of it could change based on that. It's just an administrative difficulty in knowing for sure. And there's also and some other clerks that actually know about this that are here might want to elaborate on that. But because to me it may be preferable to say the exact amount if you can. But I think until the print, another difficulty may relate to the fact that printing has to occur first before you kind of can weigh. And there's just some difficulties that might be something that could be overcome. But we ended up, you're correct, we sort of backed off the original proposal to say the exact amount. But that's, we're kind of encouraging this kind of input on whether we could or should say that.
So. I do have a question for you then. Are some voters actually sending in, instead of sending in a photocopy of their ID, are they actually sending in their licenses or their...
Oh, no, I don't think so. But
so
they do
so
have
we're
to
really talking about one piece of paper, which I would think would not add to the weight.
Okay.
But maybe it does.
Well, we will probably have somebody, perhaps somebody would like to come back to that point.
And then moving on, 37.3.1, I fully agree with Mr. Lackland's comments regarding rules addressing ballot marking devices. I believe I stated this in the last time I was at rulemaking hearing. And then to move on to 37.3.3 and 37.3.4, fully agree with Jenny Flanagan. I think I've stated many times that the 2002 accessibility requirements in the FEC standards are not, from our opinion, good enough to provide for full accessibility or the maximum level of accessibility. The 2005 VVSG is much closer. Even that has a few problems, but it's certainly preferable. The other thing is that I believe our state statute and existing rules far exceed what the 2002 FEC requirements are for accessibility. And I'll give you one example, and that is that in our state statute and in our rules, simultaneous audio and visual access is required, and yet that is not provided, and that is not required under the 2002 standards. And some of the systems that were certified in the past in Colorado do not offer that. So that's a significant concern for me. I'm also concerned that counties would be purchasing machines certified under the 2002 standards that are essentially already obsolete. I understand where there might be a situation where they might need to, in terms of compatibility with the system that they already have in place, they might need to, but I'm just concerned that they would be buying machines that are not accessible enough when there might be new machines available that provide greater accessibility and are more compliant with state requirements. And then I agree with Common Cause comments on the planning for vote center elections and electronic poll books. And then I just wanted to make a comment about the auto mark. I'm very disappointed to hear that ES&S withdrew the auto mark. I believe that we had solved just about all the problems that our community had with the auto mark with Senate Bill 83. The only remaining problem or concern with the auto mark was that it does not tell a voter what their write-in ballot was. It doesn't specify. It just says write-in, but that was something that I felt we could live with. Denver, looks like Denver's going to paper ballots, and so if the DREs are certified, we're going to have a situation where you're going to have primarily voters with some disabilities voting on the DREs and everybody else voting on paper, and I'm concerned that segregates the vote. So I'm very disappointed to hear that AutoMark has withdrawn, and personally, I don't see any other ballot marking device on the market today that comes anywhere close to being accessible enough. providing what the auto mark provides. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Mark Emmer, is that, I don't know whether I have that name right or not.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to comment on proposed changes to Rule 5.4. I know you've been talking about elections all morning, and I'm changing the subject here to Water Conservancy District petitions. Even though I have pretty strong feelings about electronic voting machines as a computer engineer. My name is Mark Emmer. As I said, I reside in Chaffee County and within the boundaries of the Upper Arkansas Water Conservancy District. I believe you have copies of my testimony and some exhibits, and rather than read it into the record, I'll just summarize some of the issues and maybe walk you through a couple of the exhibits that I think are important to look at to understand the basis for the need for a rule change. Water Conservancy Districts are currently covered by your rules to the extent that citizens may initiate petitions to force the election of a director of a Water Conservancy District. Normally, directors are appointed by the court. In Chaffee County, where our water district exercises considerable power, it was necessary to do some director elections or attempt director elections to exercise some control over this agency. And because of your rules, we followed your requirements for petitions as they would for any statewide initiative. And in my exhibits there, Exhibit A is a reduced version of a petition that I put together in 2001 showing all the cautions, the block form requiring people to print their names and county, date of signing, et cetera. And not only did that give us a petition that was easy to look at, it was easy for the opponents of this election to do their own verification because they could read the names, they could see that things were signed in the proper order. In fact, we did go to court to dispute on a dispute on this. And the judge was able to look at this and see that the signing dates were consecutively increasing. And that gave him confidence in this petition. We did another director-elected petition in 2002. I put an example of that page, and it's pretty similar as my Exhibit B. We actually called off that petition because we negotiated a settlement with the Water District and with the judge on another way of perhaps selecting directors. That's by way of background because that's currently covered by your Rule 5.4. The other petitions that happen within water districts is for the inclusion of additional lands into the water district. People in eastern Fremont County in 2004 and 2005 attempted to petition into the water district, and they did so under 3745.136 subsection 3, which takes you directly from a petition to an inclusion with no election. Because there's no election, it probably is not subject to Secretary of State oversight. But to give you an example of what they did, because it does show the problems we have with petitions, I have a page on my Exhibit C that shows the kind of petitions they submitted. And what you see here is that all signatures on the petition are undated. Many of the names are not printed. The addresses are incomplete. There are entries that were corrected or annotated by the circulator trying to explain what the person's name was or where they lived. The pages were not numbered. The sections were not numbered. Petition sections were disassembled. They were not assembled to begin with. Some of them were just stacks of paper with paper clips when they were submitted to the court. And sometimes there was one circulator affidavit for multiple petition sections. And finally, they never designated who the proponents or the petition representatives were on the petition, which led to some substantial problems in court when we couldn't figure out who was putting on the case for the petitioners. Judge asked the petitioners, put on your case. There was silence in the courtroom because they hadn't figured out who their representative was, and they hadn't designated it in the petition. Dan Slater, who you may know, was my co-plaintiff in this, and he called it the sloppiest petitions he had ever seen. Nevertheless, the court accepted them on form. And I had to spend literally hundreds of hours trying to decipher signatures and writing computer software to do fuzzy pattern matching to try to figure out who these people were. In the end, we disqualified that petition based on insufficient number of signatures, not on form. Having cautioned them that these were very poor petitions, they came back in 2006 with essentially the same petition form, this time under 136 subsection 3.5, which does lead to an election for the inclusion. Because it does lead to access to the state's election machinery, it should fall under Secretary of State guidance or oversight. Exhibit D, my last exhibit, is an example of one of their petitions. You can see at the bottom it says page blank of the petition. Nobody bothered to even fill it out. Their petition pages often were unnumbered. There was no petition representative. In this case, the cover sheet wasn't dated. And inside, the petitions have the same problem: incomplete addresses, illegible names, all of the problems they had in 2005, they repeated in this petition, which was now leading to an election. Again, the judge refused to disqualify the petitions on the basis of form. And in this case, they got their election. It wasn't because they had adequate signatures. I think they did not. It was because the objector, who was officially the plaintiff in this case, sold his land in Fremont County and was no longer had standing in the case. And without anybody to contest at the hearing, the judge just took the petitions in. I think had he had standing and had this continued and had it been appealed, these petitions would have been disqualified on form by an appeals court. So with that as a background of how we got here, your Rule 5.4 needs to be extended to cover these types of petitions. One of the judge's arguments for not disqualifying these on form was it doesn't specify it in 5.4. We brought it out. We showed him the Secretary of State's authorization to make rules covering elections. The judge said no. So with that, I have some specific comments on the rules that are being proposed. There are some clerical problems in what I see proposed here. In particular, you did an amendment of your rules in October that eliminated Rule 22, which is the details of how you verify a petition. And I understand that that has now been distributed into Rule 17 and Rule 18. However, the proposed amendment here continues to refer to Rule 22. So you've got a clerical problem here. I think your 5.4.1, where it just says Rule 22, I think that just needs to be changed to Rule 17. Five point four point two is not proposed for amendment in this at this time, but it does refer to Rule 22.4, which doesn't exist any longer. I think that should be Rule 18, the statement of sufficiency. Your proposed changes to 5.4.5 and 5.4.6 are fine as written. And finally, there's another problem that is not proposed for rule amendment today, and I'm going to suggest that you consider this for a future rule amendment. 5.4.1 states that the verification process shall be directed by the Water Conservancy District named in the petition rather than the Secretary of State. In fact, it's the court that directs this process, not the Water Conservancy District. So you might consider fixing that in the future. For director elections, it doesn't really say what happens. It says you file the petitions with the clerk of the court, and if they're adequate, the court shall order the holding of an election. For inclusion elections, as the one we're about to have or just had. Here it's pretty clear. On the day fixed for the hearing or a continuance thereof, the court shall first ascertain such evidence which may be adduced that the required number of electors of the area to be included in the district have signed the petition. So the verification process is really covered by the court, not by the Water Conservancy District.
I'm sorry, which rule was that?
That is 541.
Okay.
Your existing rule has a section about who does the verification process. I did not put it in my notes, and I just noticed it while I was sitting in the chair here. You have a similar problem in 542, where it says that the sufficiency statement is issued by the Water Conservancy District. And I believe that's also incorrect. The sufficiency statement was issued by the court. So I think those last two items of 541 and 542 regarding who does verification, who issues sufficiency, may be the subject of future rulemaking after you study it. But I think the other rules, proposals with their that small clerical change, eliminating Rule 22, is probably ripe for approval. Just in summary, I think it's very unfair that proponents of director elections are held to a very high standard of petition integrity, while those who propose petitions for inclusion are able to submit the kind of material you see here today. It needs to be some equalization. 5-4 can start to address this problem. Ultimately, we probably need legislative remedy for some of the problems in the water district statute. I'll entertain any questions if you have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Emmer? Thank you very much. Okay. That actually is everybody that I think has signed up. Is there anybody who's signed up to testify that I haven't called upon? And then I also want to kind of go back. There were some people who signed up, weren't sure whether they wanted to testify. Plus, I think some folks might want to clarify about the postage, might make some comments about postage, which would be very helpful. So, you know, if anybody else who has signed up or who wants to sign up, here's an opportunity to give us some better information or suggestions. Hillary, do you want Hillary Hall? Okay.
Hillary Hall, Boulder County Clerk and Recorder. Wanted to speak to the postage issue. Some of the challenges are different ballot styles and pages depending on which jurisdiction. So how do you write, how do you affix on the envelope what the postage is and the additional cost if you have to have your the company that you contract with do additional insertions. One of the ways we addressed this in this past election was to use press releases on our website to advertise that information once we knew, because you print your envelopes long before you have your ballot finalized, and so that was one of the ways we addressed it. Plus, voters could call in and we would give them the correct postage based on if they needed ID or not. Another issue, and of course this is a slightly bit beyond the scope of the Secretary of State's office, but the partner in this is the post office. We ran a special election in July, and we had one of the post stations saying that a one-page ballot and an envelope were not did not weigh properly for a first-class stamp. And so we actually had to go and work with the postmaster to correct that. So there is that issue. One of the possibilities we're looking at within our county is if people make an attempt to meet the postage needs, for instance, if we say it's a first-class stamp and there is a postal station that doesn't take that, then we would go ahead and take on that cost. What we're trying to avoid is people who, through this process, object to having to put a stamp on, especially since we make walk-in, drop-off, and all those hand deliveries available to them, for people who decide they're going to put a one-cent stamp on, knowing that that is in no way going to sufficiently cover the cost of postage, and therefore adding an additional cost that is not budgeted for two clerk and recorder's offices, and in the long run, take away from funding for our other. So those are the issues that we're wrestling with. And in addition, we actually do have people who send in driver's license, passports, medical cards in their ballot, and of course we pick up the postage, the additional postage, and then mail and return those identifications to them. So I think postage is an ongoing issue, and that another, at some point, I think including the post office in those conversations. Mm-hmm. Perhaps even having the Secretary of State involved in that conversation would go a long way to helping us iron out some of these difficulties that we run into.
So do you think, go ahead, Mr. Musser.
Well, Hillary, I was just wondering, how far out do you have to start printing your envelopes and before the election? How many days do you estimate?
We usually turn that order in, it's usually a couple weeks even before we have the ballot certified. And the reason for that is just it's one more step that we can get taken care of ahead of time, and then it gets us a better rate because the later the later you get in ordering, it usually has an effect on the price, unfortunately.
Right.
And that's part of our contracting with those companies. And also for them, because usually the same people who are going to print your ballots often will print your envelope as well, and for them to be able to really focus on the ballot, they also want that taken care of.
Not to mention you have other counties that are trying,
the
that
same
are getting
vendors,
in line.
Exactly, and so that's, it is really.
And that's what I was getting to is, mm-hmm. you know, we don't even certify state content to you until 60 days before a primary
exactly.
and 57 days before a general, so you don't know what you're going to be getting from the state.
Correct, and that's why we really, whatever details we can get taken care of, and so if we could look for an alternative method,
right.
and unfortunately inserting something additional into the ballot will just increase costs because, again, then you're having your insertion person have to customize what postage insertion goes into each one. So the other thing we are looking at, though, is another option is do you just, at the time of inserting the ballot, have a postage sheet, depending on what style you are. But then again, that's it's complicated. So, but we're looking for solutions.
And are you okay with the proposed rule as it's currently drafted, that you simply would, you could pre-print that extra postage may be required?
Yeah, and that's often what the envelope already says.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
And then that's where the ambiguity comes from. So what we're, it's again, it's the partnership with both the press and the voter of here's the way for you to find out that information. And the other thing is, one other issue that came up, the 20-minute voting rule, that's our favored interpretation. But with that, one of the concerns I have after listening to Faith Gross is that what do we do? I mean, if the whole point of that rule, my interpretation is that it's to prohibit intentional disruption of an election. So it sounds like now if I was organizing an intentional disruption of an election, I would just have to tell them you have a disability. And we as a clerk have no recourse. And so how do you balance that? I mean, statistically, you could look at if everyone in your voting booth at the same time was saying, oh, I have a disability, and stayed there as long as they needed. How do we, I mean, my intent of that rule was to address that. So what do we as a clerk have as a legal recourse? And so we, in our solution, we still need to look at how do we balance those. And I'd love some suggestions of, because we all want the same thing. Those who legitimately need the time, we want to give it to them. And those who are there to disrupt, we want to have a recourse to allow them to not.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who'd like to testify? Yes, sir, Mr. Lachlan, go. Yes, sir. Identify yourself again for the record.
Yes, my name is Kerry Lachlan. I'm with Colorado's for Voting Integrity, and I've had a chance to regain my composure after Ms. Mirababa informed me that Automark has withdrawn their certification. I assume that may have been driven by two issues. One, I was aware that Secretary Kaufman had suspended ESNS's certification because of lack of cooperation or lack of documentation. I don't know if ESNS got caught in a time bind because of the additional documentation that would have been required by Automark. Also, Automark is got crossways with Secretary of State Bowen in California because they modified the hardware on Automark and did not adequately inform the Secretary of State in California, and now they're getting sued by the state of California for modifying the Automark hardware, which we don't believe affected its functionality in the election or its benefit as an accessible device for the disabled voter, but our review of the documentation that ESMS submitted to the Secretary of State's office back in the spring and summer on AutoMark was sufficient for the certification of AutoMark. We believe that AutoMark is a good machine. It's been certified in 48 states. I think any changes that have been made since AutoMark was certified previously in California or in all the other 47 states are improvements to the functionality and accessibility of AutoMark, and I think are in response to two things. The changes ESNS made to AutoMark or AutoMark made to their machine were in response to the California top-to-bottom review by a team of technical experts and accessibility experts, one of whom was Noel Runyon, who actually testified in the Conway versus Dennis lawsuit in Colorado. He's now Secretary Bowen's accessibility manager of her elections. And I spoke with him recently about AutoMark and the problems they were having in California. And he said he was still a supporter of AutoMark, and he thought that AutoMark would be certified, at least conditionally. And I would encourage the Colorado Secretary of State to, despite ESNS's withdrawal of their certification, I think you have the power to conditionally certify AutoMark pending whatever deficiencies ESNS identified in their initial application. I think it's time to move forward as one of the two states. We're in the company of Arkansas as one of two states have not certified AutoMark or some other ballot marking device. I think it's time for Colorado to take advantage and Colorado voters and especially disabled voters that need accessibility to these type of machines to have the benefit of a ballot marking device. It prevents the impression that there's a second-class voter or a second-class machine. It allows a county like Boulder County to move to a total paper ballot with an accessible paper ballot marking device. I think a lot of counties are on the cusp right now of trying to decide which way to go. And I realize that AutoMark, there are counties now who are on the cusp of making a decision of what to buy. And I think some of those counties would buy AutoMark if they were conditionally certified by the Colorado Secretary of State. So I'm not clear about why ESNS withdrew their certification. I just made a call to Steve Pearson, who we worked with hand-in-hand during the Senate Bill 83 process when we were working with the disabled community in Colorado trying to meet concerns about AutoMark. I think we put a lot of effort into that, and it's very disappointing to hear that certification has been withdrawn.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody else who'd like to testify this morning? I think I would like to leave the rulemaking record open until the... Oh, Karen, is that... I'm sorry. I'll just go ahead and say what I'm going to do is, for those who are wondering about whether this speak now or forever, you know, lose your chance, I'll leave the rulemaking record open until the close of business on Monday, which I think is December 3rd. So if anybody wants to submit additional written comments, you could submit them to the Secretary of State by the close of business on Monday. And I think they should be directed to Andrea Geiger. And I think it's just andrea.geiger@sos.state.co.us is the email address. And we can, if anybody didn't get that, we can, or also just fax or whatever, we can provide additional contact information. So, Ms. Long, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Karen Long. I'm the Adams County Clerk and Recorder. And I only have a couple of comments. First one being, pertaining to Rule 2.11, at the end of the paragraph, it says, for the purposes of this rule, in writing shall include correspondence delivered in person or by U.S. mail, fax, or email. If this rule stays, I would suggest that it needs to clarify that U.S. mail, fax, or email needs to suggest it has to be from the voter. In other words, you know, groups can't email that, please activate these voters, or fax, or mail us something. So I think if the rule stays as it is, it needs to designate that that needs to come from the voter. And regarding the postage, the only other thing I wanted to add is an important piece to what Hillary said is that some of us have as far as 4 months out that we're ordering envelopes and secrecy sleeves which have the pertinent information on it we're speaking of. But also a piece that probably doesn't get much thought is the weight of your ballot stock plays a big part in determining the postage. And if you don't have your vendor send you the ballot stock that they're actually going to use to print your ballot on, you can easily be suggesting to the voter in giving an exact amount early on that you perhaps, it can really make a big difference. I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you very much. Anybody else? If not, then we'll conclude the hearing, and again, I'll leave the rulemaking record open for additional written comments until the close of business on Monday, December 3rd. And again, for the record, then we'll adjourn, and the time is 10:35 a.m. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.